David Suzuki is an internationally renowned geneticist, environmentalist, co-founder of the David Suzuki Foundation, author of more than 40 books, recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, Companion of the Order of Canada, holds multiple honorary degrees, and has been adopted into 3 First Nations clans. David is one of those unique individuals who challenges and inspires us, who presents us with the stark reality of the dangers that our earth faces, but gives us the hope and confidence that we can save, repair, and create a better world. So tonight, I'd like to welcome David Suzuki.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. This is really the launch of the first night of a trip across the country talking about both the book and the film. So thank you very much for such a great show up for this one tonight. Some of the material that I'm going to cover was part of the lecture that I gave for the Legacy Lecture at UBC. I hope there may be a few of you here that heard that, but if you feel, oh God, I've heard this before, too bad. Thank you for coming. In many universities, there's a tradition where an esteemed or an eminent professor at the end of her or his career is asked to give a final lecture, a summation of knowledge accumulated over an academic career. No one ever asked me to do that at UBC. But when I was, and I taught at UBC for 39 years, but when I was asked to be part of a feature film, it was decided that we would do a final lecture, as if I was at the end of my career or at the end of my life, whatever, and that we would stage it at the Chan Center at UBC. And that became the spine of the film. When one hits 70 years of age, you can't deny that you're old. And that where I call it the death zone. We're in the death zone. There's nothing morbid about that. We're all going to die. And we'd better accept it and get on with the final job in our life. We've got to reflect back over that life and sift through experiences, observations, and thoughts to distill a legacy, something to pass on to future generations. I was asked a few months ago by a reporter who said, well, what do you want people to say about you after you're gone? And I was absolutely stunned by that question, because my answer was, I don't give a shit what they say about me after I'm gone. I'm going to be dead. Once we're gone, what difference does it make? A legacy implies a gift or something to leave on. And for me, that is a few ideas that I'd like to share with you tonight that I hope will continue to be pondered after I've kicked the bucket. You know, Moses Neimer is now an elder, but he doesn't like to be called an elder. So he's invented this term, Zoomer. You know, and I have this image of somebody in a wheelchair zooming around. Well, I just think that's a lot of crap. I think we should be called tumors, you know? These are people who know we're at the end of our lives, and so we can offer a great gift that age brings. We can say it like it is without worrying about salaries or money or honors or power. We're at the end of our life, and we can speak from the heart. And so I offer my legacy and hope that it will prompt every one of you, even though you are not elders, it will prompt you to begin to wonder about your own lives and what legacy that you would like to leave. To ask questions like, what is life all about? What matters the most in our lives? And what brings us the greatest joy and happiness? I began my career, my adult career, in 1961 after I got my PhD and became a scientist. And looking back over the speeches that I've given since that time, it's interesting to see the shifts in the material that I covered. I was trained as a geneticist, and so for years my early speeches were all about concerns about eugenics and cloning and genetic engineering. But then there was a fight against nuclear war as the superpowers were arming with nuclear weapons in crazy amounts. There were civil rights issues that I was concerned with, and of course the Vietnam War that we were concerned about here, and the environmental movement that began in the 60s, fights against clear-cut logging in this province and air pollution and mega dams. And we were pressing for years for preservation of wilderness and better laws to protect the air, the water, the soil. And we were asking politicians to tax things that we don't like. Then about 30 years ago, Tara and I, my wife and I, became involved with First Nations people, and we've never left with friends and family among the First Nations. So as I look over the many issues that we've been involved in over a lifetime, I realize that the issues over time have changed, but the age-old questions keep coming up over and over. Who the hell are we? How did we get here? And what's it all about? Now, in the past, every culture had its own answers to those questions. We have them in our creation myths. The Norse myth, for example, tells of the giant Ymir, who, when he was murdered, his skull and his hair and his blood and his bones became the heavens. They became the land and the oceans and the forests. The Haida myths tell of Raven picking up a clam and dropping the clam on a beach, and from that clam crawled the first human beings. Well, today it's science that is providing many insights into these questions. And when you think about the answers that science is providing to these ancient questions, they're every bit as fantastic as the creation myths in cultures around the world. To me, one of the most astonishing developments in the last 40 years has been our insights into DNA, the genetic material, and the ways that scientists can now manipulate this genetic material. And one of the amazing achievements of the 20th century was the actual delineation of the sequence of the 3 billion letters in the DNA in the nucleus of a single human cell, the so-called human genome. To determine the sequence of all the letters in that genome was the equivalent of deciphering all of the words and letters in 1,000 volumes of the complete works of Shakespeare. And scientists, of course, once the human genome was determined, scientists boast that, oh, now we're going to determine the cause of disease and invent new drugs and cure cancer and all this. That's just all bullshit that they say to get more money. But the reality is, the most astonishing discovery that came out of the human genome is that 99% of the genes in our cells are identical to the genes in the great apes. They are our nearest relatives. But more than that, every one of us carries thousands of genes identical to the genes in our pet dogs and cats, identical to the genes in salmon, in eagles, in fruit flies, dandelions, and cedar trees. All life is related through our common evolutionary history. And if we look at other species as our kin, our relatives, surely we treat our relatives in a different way from something that we simply regard as a resource or a pest or a weed or a vermin. I'd like you to perform a thought exercise that may give us a different insight into other species on the planet. Try to imagine that scientists have made a great technological breakthrough. They've discovered time travel, taking us back 4 billion years. That is, we're going to go back in the Earth's history to a time before any life existed on Earth, when the planet was sterile. So I push the button, boom, we're back 4 billion years. And of course, we'd immediately want to know, what is the Earth like before there was life on it? So we all rush to the door, rush out, and every one of us is dead as a doornail within 5 minutes. Why? Because before plants evolved on the planet, the air was toxic for an animal like us. It was filled with water vapor, carbon dioxide, and all kinds of other stuff, but there was no oxygen. Oxygen became a part of the atmosphere when plants discovered photosynthesis and began to produce oxygen as a byproduct. It is life that created the very air that animals like us depend on, and to this very day, it is all the green things in the oceans and on land that are taking carbon dioxide out of the air and putting oxygen back in it. Our crisis with climate, of course, is that we are overwhelming the capacity of green things to absorb the carbon we're generating by burning more and more fossil fuels, and that is accumulating as greenhouse gases around the planet. Okay, we knew that there wouldn't be any air that was breathable, so if you reach under your seat, every one of you will find a big tank of compressed air there. So we put the tank on our backs and put our mask over our face, turn on the tank, and out we go. After a few hours, remember there was a lot of water vapor and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It was very warm on the surface of the planet. After a while, I would think, be pretty thirsty. Where would you find something to drink before there was any life on it? I mean, there's lots of water around it, but life is an integral part of the hydrologic cycle. It's life that filters the water as it percolates through the soil. We get our water in Vancouver from three watersheds surrounded by old-growth rainforest, and all of the tree roots and the other plants and soil fungi and bacteria filter that water so that we can drink it. Before there was any life on Earth, where could we find water that we would trust to drink? So again, it's life that cleansed the water, that cleanses the water for us so that we can drink. Okay, well, we knew that. If you reach further under your chair, there's a big glass bottle, not plastic. You don't want to ruin your sex life. There's a glass bottle of water. So we clip that onto our helmet. There's a little straw, and we can drink that water. And so we're all happy as a clam. But after a few more hours, I would imagine you'd get hungry. Where would you find anything to eat before there was any life on Earth? Every bit of the food that we eat for our nutrition was once alive. So before there was any life on Earth, animals like us could never find anything to eat. Well, we knew that too. I've got a big stash of food here. But not only that, we're going to stay for a couple of weeks. So I even brought some seeds to plant for. Maybe we could have some greens and supplement our food. Where would we find soil to plant our seeds? Oh, there's plenty of dust and clay and gravel and sand. But before life appeared, there was no soil anywhere on Earth, because soil is created by life. As life dies and gives up its macromolecules, it mixes with the matrix of sand and clay and eventually becomes soil. So before there was any life on Earth, there was no soil and there was nothing for an animal like us to eat. After the sun sets, I would imagine we've been around now for 4 billion years ago for a while, we'd get a bit homesick. And maybe some of us would like to light a fire. So before there was any life on Earth, where would we find anything to burn on the planet? Wood, peat, dung, oil, coal, gas. All of that is created by plants. Plants that capture the sun's energy through photosynthesis and then store it in their carcasses. Before there was any life on Earth, there was no fuel for us to burn. Well, again, we knew that. I brought some wood and kindling and paper. So we curl up the paper, we put the kindling on and the wood, and then we take a match. And guess what? Before there was any life on Earth, there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. There was no fire on the planet. So the point of this thought exercise is that it's the web of living things, what scientists call biological diversity, biodiversity. Our relatives, the plants and other animals around the earth, that create the very things that keep us alive. And to this day, they are the source of the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and the capturing of sunlight through photosynthesis. We boast, our great boast is that we're intelligent. Oh, we're a clever animal. But what intelligent creature, knowing that air, water, and soil are the critical elements that keep us alive, knowing that other species are what generate our most primary needs, would then proceed to use air, water, and soil as a toxic dump of the most potent chemicals ever devised, that would then proceed to destroy habitat and species. It drives species to extinction at a rate not seen on the planet for 65 million years. We fool ourselves if we think that we can extirpate 50,000 species a year, destroy ecosystems, and poison our surroundings and not think it will affect us. Scientists can use DNA to trace the movement of our species through time. Another astonishing feat. And all of the trails lead back to Africa. We're all Africans. So that makes me laugh when I see the Ku Klux Klan and all these guys, these pointy-headed guys. They're Africans, for God's sakes. We all are. We were born in the plains of Africa, and try to imagine what the world was like when our species appeared on Earth. There were still woolly mammoths on the planet. There were saber-toothed tigers and Tasmanian devils. The world was a very different place, and the Serengeti must have been filled with animals in size and number beyond anything we can imagine today. So thinking back in that way, these funny-looking two-legged naked apes were not very impressive. I'm sure that no other species looked at us and went, "Oh my God, watch out for those critters, they're going to take over the planet." I mean, what the hell did we have going for us? There weren't very many of us. We weren't very big or strong or fast, and we certainly weren't endowed with sensory ability. I keep trying to imagine swinging through the trees on a vine without my glasses. I mean, no way I would survive. And of course, this very ordinary looking ape that was our ancestors had an ability that was invisible. It was hidden from view because it was buried deep in his skull. It was a 2-kilogram organ, the brain, that was the secret to our success. That brain was the most complex structure that we know of in the universe. That brain endowed us with a massive memory, with curiosity and creativity. And those qualities conferred by the brain more than compensated for our lack of physical or sensory ability. That brain was aware of itself, and it was aware of itself in time and space. That's a remarkable thing. That brain was able to look out and observe and analyze those observations. It remembered things. It tried. It learned things by trial and error. That brain was able to imagine a future using its experience and accumulating knowledge. That brain imagined what a future could be like. And we could dream of a world that didn't exist, but that might be a world in which we avoid dangers and exploit opportunities. And by dreaming of that future, we could make it happen, because we could then determine how to act in order to reach that future. Foresight was the great advantage we had over any other species on the planet. And foresight, by looking ahead and imagining that future, we in fact were able to become the dominant animal on the planet in only 150,000 years. We moved onto every continent. And just to get an idea of the explosive change that has happened, when the agricultural revolution began 10,000 years ago, there were only 10 million human beings on the planet. That's all over the earth, 10,000 years ago. When Jesus Christ was said to be born, there were estimated to be 100 million people. So that's a tremendous increase in only 2,000 years. But then it took almost 2,000 more years, about 200 years ago, when we finally reached the first 1 billion people on Earth. And today, that number in only 200 years has exploded to 6.8 billion, and by the middle of this century, it could be up to 9 billion. We are now the most numerous mammal on the planet. There's a law, or there seems to be a rule, that the bigger you are, the fewer animals there are. Any species, the number seems to be a function of size. So the smaller you are, the more of you there are. So when you're a whale or an elephant, the numbers are in the thousands, whereas when you're a tiny creature, the number can be in the tens of millions. We have gone against that principle. We are now the most numerous mammal species on the planet. There are more of us than all the mice. There are more of us than all the rats, than all the rabbits. So, and we're a hell of a lot bigger than them. And the mere fact of living means that every one of us needs to breathe the air. We need to drink water, eat food, clothe and shelter ourselves. Simply surviving means that we have a very large ecological footprint as a species. It takes a lot of land, air, and water to support us, just to keep us alive. But of course, we're not like rabbits or rats or mice. And we have virtually all of modern technology has been created in the last 150 years, from cars and telephones and radios, right up through satellites and birth control pills and iPhones and all of that stuff. All of that has become a part of our lives in less than 150 years. And all of that amplifies our exploitation of the planet. We have also increased radically since the last World War our consumptive patterns. My mother and father were born before the Great Depression, and they lived through the Depression as adults. And they taught us very simple things that they had learned as Depression survivors. Live within your means. Save some for tomorrow. You need money for the necessities in life, but you don't run after money as if it makes you a better, more important person. Help your neighbor, because there'll come a time when you'll need help from your neighbor. Those simple things have all changed. They've been thrown out as consumption has become a fundamental part of our economy. And now we define our very selves as consumers. That's our, not as parents or not as Catholics or Jews, but consumers is our primary role in society. And that again amplifies what we have to take out of the earth. And that amplification is accelerated by a global economy that now uses material from all over the planet. And we're not even aware of what we are taking because materials, you think of your computers, your cars, your television sets, have dozens and dozens of different minerals that have been mined and processed to put into those machines. But we just want to go out and buy a Toshiba or a Sony or a GM car, and we don't understand that the way we act and our consumptive habits affect the entire planet. So when you add all of those things up, our numbers, our technological power, our consumptive patterns, and a global economy, we have become a species as no other species has ever existed in the 3.8 billion years of life on this earth. I remember only a few years ago that we used to refer to storms, to floods and drought, hurricanes, to forest fires as natural disasters. Or we called them acts of God. Well, that may have been true a few decades ago, but it sure as hell isn't true today. Because you can see the human imprint in all of these phenomena that are occurring. We have become a force of nature. We indeed have tried to assume the place of a God in influencing these forces that affect our lives. We, scientists now, they define different eras by whether it was an ice age or what, there's a Holocene era. And now they call this the Anthropocene era. This is a moment when human beings have become so powerful, we are actually shaping the physical, chemical, and biological features of the planet on a geological scale. To come to grips with how powerful we have become as a species, we have to see the world as it really is and then see where we belong in that world. The problem is that the way we see the world is shaped by our backgrounds, is shaped by our upbringing, our gender, by our religion, by our socioeconomic class. We learn to see the world in certain ways. Just ask a man and a woman about love or family, and you'd swear they were a different species. I mean, ask a Bay Street investment person with and a Bay Street beggar to talk about money and the economy, and you'll get radically different answers. Ask an Israeli and a Palestinian about Gaza, and you'll get radically different answers. We see the world through the perceptual lenses that are shaped by our background. Many years ago, I went to Peru with Wade Davis, and he took me to a village on a mountain, and he told me that the children there are taught that the mountain that their village is on is an apu. Apu in their language means God. And as long as that mountain casts its shadow on the village, it will determine the fate of all of the people in that village. And Wade said to me, you can imagine how those children, when they grow up, treat that mountain compared to a kid that grows up in Trail BC and is taught all their lives, I'll bet those mountains are full of gold and silver. The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it. Is a forest a sacred grove, or is it simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the veins of the land, or simply an opportunity for irrigation or power? Is another species our biological kin, or simply a commodity or a resource? Is our property a home, or simply real estate? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a speech by famous geneticist, broadcaster, and author David Suzuki. For almost 50 years, he hosted the Canadian broadcasting TV show, The Nature of Things. He published 40 books and won many awards. This is his legacy speech before the release of a biographical film, David Suzuki, A Force of Nature, at the Toronto Film Festival. Recorded by Alex Smith at a standing-room-only auditorium at the Kitsilano High School, Vancouver, on September 17, 2010. As we continue, Dr. Suzuki tries to place humans in proper perspective in the real world.
And something has fundamentally changed our perception of the world around us. You see, for most of human history, we existed as a local tribal animal. We may have traveled in a lifetime a few hundred kilometers. We may have known well 100, 200 people in a lifetime. That was it. We only had to worry about our tribe and our local territory or a few territories that were fighting us. But it was a very limited view of the world. Even in 1900, there were only 1.5 billion people in the world. And when you look at how we lived in 1900, there were only 14 cities with more than 1 million people. London was the largest, with 6.5 million people. There wasn't a city in Canada with 1 million people. The vast majority of people around the world lived in rural villages or towns. We were a farming species. Most people in the world were associated with the activity of farming. And farmers know we are absolutely dependent on weather and climate for our livelihoods and well-being. Farmers know that the amount of moisture in the soil is related to the amount of snow in winter. They know that we need insects to pollinate plants, that some insects are pests, but others are vital. They know that certain plants take nitrogen from the air and fix it as fertilizer in the soil, and other plants are weeds. Farmers know that we are a part of nature and utterly dependent on it. In only 100 years, that perception has been fundamentally altered as we've changed radically in the way that we live. By the year 2000, in only 100 years, our population had quadrupled to 6 billion people, but now there were more than 400 cities with more than 1 million people. Tokyo became the largest city in the world with 26 million people. The 10 largest cities in the world all had more than 11 million people. In countries like Canada, 85% of us now live in big cities. So in only a century, we've been transformed from a farming species to a big city dweller. And in a big city, the way you look at the world is completely different. I have a friend who lives in Toronto, and he tells me he lives in an air-conditioned apartment building. He goes down the elevator in the morning into the air-conditioned garage, gets into his car, and drives downtown in an air-conditioned car into the basement of his commercial building and up into his air-conditioned office. He said, "David, I never have to go outside for days on end." In a city, nature is something that is out there. Maybe you take a holiday and go to a park and go camping, but nature is no longer a part that is obvious in your world. In a city, then, we think that our highest priority is our job, because our job is the way we earn money, and money is the way that we get the important things that we need. And so we now have altered our perception of our place on this planet because we are city dwellers. For the first time in human history, we have to ask the question, what is the collective impact of all 6.8 billion human beings in the world? We've never had to do that before, and it's very, very difficult. And it's especially difficult when nature or the biosphere is something that is increasingly distant from us. So in 1900, we understood our place in nature. Today, we think that we are dominated by economics. Economics and ecology are derived from the same root word, the Greek word ekos, meaning household or domain. Ecology is the study of home. Economics is the management of home. What ecologists try to do is to determine what is it that allows a species to survive and flourish. Now, I would have thought that would be the most important biology or science that we could possibly have. The keys to our survival and well-being are told to us by ecologists. And then I would have thought that economists would say, "Oh, gee, what are those ecologists saying? Because we don't want to do anything that is going to violate the principles and conditions that allow a species to survive and flourish." But no, we are so focused on economics today that we have elevated economics above ecology. We hear it when our prime minister says, "Oh, I can't do anything about climate change, it'll destroy the economy." So the economy is elevated above ecology. Lorne Taylor, when he was minister of the environment in Alberta, said, "These damned enviros better understand, we can't afford to do what they want unless the economy is growing and healthy." So even the minister of the environment, whose job is to protect the environment, thinks the economy is the source of everything that allows him to do his business. So let's put the eco back into economics. Because I keep getting told over and over again by politicians and business people, "Listen, Suzuki, you have to be realistic. The economy is the bottom line. And unless we have a good economy, you guys are just way out of line." That's why I recently did a 10-part series on CBC called The Bottom Line, because I wanted to define the real bottom line that we have to pay attention to. That real bottom line is dictated by the fact that we live in a world that's determined, in which our lives are constrained by the laws of physics. Things like gravity, the speed of light, the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And they tell us there is no such thing then as a perpetual motion machine. You can't travel faster than the speed of light. You can't build an anti-gravity machine. We live with that because those are forces of nature, and you can't do anything to change that. We know that the laws of chemistry that determine diffusion rates and reaction rates, those are things that you have to live with as well. And then there is the biological world that determines that as biological creatures, we have to have clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, and other living things, or we don't survive. That's reality. Those are facts determined by the biological dictates. Other things, capitalism, free enterprise, corporations, currency, markets, economies, Those aren't forces of nature. We invented the damn things. So if they don't work, the last thing you want to do is keep trying to prop them up and keep going the way they're gone on. You can change them. Einstein said that the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. The 2008 meltdown was a real opportunity, an opportunity to say something's wrong here, and an opportunity to get things right. But what did Mr. Bush do and then Mr. Obama do? They pumped hundreds of billions of dollars back into the banks that created the crisis, back into the auto sector without any strings attached, and just said, please, please, please get going again. That was a totally missed opportunity. These are not forces of nature, for God's sakes. They're human constructs, and they are far from perfect. We can't continue to treat the economy and the market as something that is sacrosanct, as if somehow they've got to be propped up at all expense. The free market, you talk to people like Preston Manning and the Fraser Institute and all of these neocons that think, oh my God, the market, man, just bow down before it and free it. What a lot of nonsense. The market is a human construct, and we can shape it so that it serves us, not the other way around. We've just had a government that has been prorogued by our prime minister to concentrate on the economy. Fair enough. That's reasonable. But what kind of an economy is our prime minister focused on? The economy is so flawed that it is inevitably destructive. You see, that economy takes no account of the services that nature performs. Right now, for example, we have a government in British Columbia that is committed to building the dam at Site C on the Peace River. We fought that battle 30 years ago, for God's sake, and we won it. And now with a different government, it's back on the agenda. Mr. Campbell is determined to build that dam. Oh, well, we'll have an environmental assessment, and once that's over, we'll build a dam. What the hell's the use of an environmental assessment if we're not going to say maybe it shouldn't be built at all? And the problem with even an environmental assessment is that no one asks the fundamental question, what about all the things that nature is doing for us for nothing that will be lost by building a dam and flooding it? You see, nature performs dozens and dozens of services that an animal like us depends upon for our very survival. All the green things take carbon dioxide out of the air, put oxygen back in it. Not a bad service for an animal like us. If we don't have it, we're dead. And yet, where in all of the calculations of the value of dams and all of this stuff do we ever see an estimate of the value of that service nature is performing? Man, we bitch like mad if someone says, we're going to have to pay money to put carbon into the atmosphere. A carbon tax, whoa, you throw that up, and we are scared stiff of that. When Mr. Dionne posed it, you saw Mr. Harper's response to that. Here was the leader of the opposition party putting his whole election or his campaign based on a carbon tax, and the Prime Minister of Canada's response to what economists consider one of the best tools we have to reduce carbon emission, his response was, that's crazy. And he never talked about it again. We saw an ad on the television showing a bird shitting on Mr. Dionne's shoulder, and this is supposed to be a serious discussion about a very serious issue. It's disgraceful what we are passing off now as serious discussion about the fate of this planet and about economics. We saw the problems in Copenhagen when 192 nations gathered at Copenhagen to deal with this crisis in the climate. The air doesn't belong to every country. It doesn't give a damn about human boundaries. And yet there were 192 nations trying to deal with a single entity, the atmosphere, as if through the lenses of their own national boundaries, we're going to be able to handle the atmosphere. It's absolutely ludicrous. It's impossible. And to compound the difficulty, every country is saying, oh, but we've got economic considerations that have to determine the way that we're going to deal with the atmosphere. We simply cannot deal with this kind of a system using human-created constructs like economics and boundaries around our countries. But I'm going to show you then why this economic system is so fundamentally flawed. Economists are so clever that they think that nature is vast, so vast that we don't have to take it into account in all of our calculations. That's why you get this very destructive, the biggest development on the planet today, which is a development going on in the tar sands of Alberta, and air, water, and land are treated as if they're free. Oh, there's a small carbon tax there that's supposed to be put into mitigating the effects of the development. But basically, they're using air, water, and land as free. They are considered externalities that aren't germane to the functioning of the economy. And as long as we discount nature or exclude nature and all of her services, then how can we have an economy that makes any sense on this planet? But the terrible thing that's happened, and I just wanted to point out that 2 weeks ago there was a headline in the Globe and Mail, and the headline was, "Plans to limit city growth mean death of the city." We've equated growth, or the absence of growth, with death. And yet, when you live in a finite world, how can anything grow forever? I mean, our bodies are made up of a lot of cells, 100 trillion cells. That's a lot of cells. But if only one cell in that 100 trillion thinks, I'm going to start dividing and I'm going to keep dividing forever, you know what happens. It'll kill us. And it doesn't have to be very big. It all depends where it happens. It'll kill us. Cancer is deadly. And yet we have economists who live within the biosphere who think the economy can grow forever. Indeed, we have now come to equate growth with the very notion of progress. And if progress is defined by growth, then nobody ever asks the important questions. How much is enough? How far can we grow in a finite world? Are we happier with all this stuff? What is an economy for? Nobody's asking the really important questions, because everybody is focused, including Mr. Obama, is focused on growth. The very definition of how well a government or corporation does is by how well it grew in the last year. Now, I know that the little video that I did with the National Film Board on exponential growth apparently has gone viral. How many people have heard my little shtick about exponential growth? Oh, a few of you. Good. But I'm going to repeat it anyway, because I think it is so critical. Any politician or corporate executive, if you ask them how well did you do last year, they will immediately define their success or failure by growth. So growth has become the focus of our attention on the economy. Anything growing steadily over time, whether it's the amount of garbage you make, whether it's the amount of land that we use in a city, whether it's the amount of water that we use or a population, anything growing steadily over time is called exponential growth. And anything growing exponentially has a predictable doubling time. So if it's growing at 1% a year, it'll double in 70 years, 2% a year in 35 years, 3% in 24 years. Anything growing steadily has a predictable doubling time. So I'm going to give you a system analogous to the planet that's a test tube full of food for bacteria. That's the planet. And I'm going to put one bacterial cell in, and it's going to divide every minute. That's exponential growth. So at the beginning, there's one cell. In 1 minute, there are two. 2 minutes, four. 3 minutes, eight. That's exponential growth. And at 60 minutes, the test tube's packed with bacteria and there's no food left. Okay? 60-minute growth. When is the test tube only half full? And the answer, of course, is at 59 minutes. They've been around 59 minutes, but 1 minute later, it'll be full. So at 58 minutes, it's 25% full. 57 minutes is 12.5% full. At 55 minutes of a 60-minute growth cycle, It's 3% full. So if at 55 minutes, one of the bacteria says, hey, guys, we got a population problem. The other bacteria would say, Jack, what the hell have you been smoking, man? 97% of the test tube's empty and we've been around for 55 minutes. They'd be 5 minutes away from filling it. So they're no smarter than human beings. At 59 minutes, they go, oh my God, Jack was right. We got 1 minute left. What the hell are we going to do? We better give that money to those scientists. And by God, in less than a minute, those scientists invent 3 new test tubes full of food for bacteria. That would be like finding 3 more planets and pulling them nearby so we could use them. So they've quadrupled the amount of food in space. So they're saved, right? So at 60 minutes, the first test tube's full. At 61 minutes, the second's full. At 62 minutes, all 4 are full. By quadrupling the amount of food in space, you buy 2 extra minutes. And every scientist I've talked to agrees with me. We're already past the 59th minute. So all of this talk about more, more, more is saying we have to accelerate what is a suicidal path. Now, when I say this to politicians and business people, they get very, very angry with me. How dare you say we're past the 59th minute? Look at our stores. They're filled with stuff. Look at our people. We're living longer. We're healthier. How dare you say that we're past? Well, I say it without apology. We are living with the illusion that everything's all right because we're using up the rightful legacy of our children and grandchildren. And we call that progress. And I call that an intergenerational crime. You don't have to believe me. Just talk to any elder that's lived in Vancouver for 80 or 90 years. What was it like here when you were a kid? Yeah, there were some things that you hated back then that were bad. Fog, deadly fog because we burned so much coal. But I can tell you that forests and wildlife and fish were in a very different state from in 80 or 90 years ago than they are today. Our elders validate the fact that we are using up our biological capital. We are using up what we should be leaving for all future generations, all in the name of growth. So we simply can't continue with these crazy notions that growth is the definition of progress and avoid asking the really important questions about economics. So what is life all about? My great hero and mentor was my father. And in 1994, he was dying. He was 85 years old. He wasn't in pain, thank goodness, and he wasn't afraid of dying. And I moved in with him the last weeks of his life. And he kept saying over and over, David, you know, I die a rich man. He didn't have a penny in his pocket. But he lived a rich, full life. And all those days that I spent with him, we had wonderful times looking at slides and talking. He never once said, do you remember that 1967 Chev that I had? Or do you remember that house I owned in London, Ontario? Or that closet full of fine clothes? Never once. That's only stuff. All we talked about were family, friends, and neighbors and the things we did together. That was his wealth. And in those things, he was truly a wealthy man. And why have we got turned off on this idea that we've got to buy stuff? That stuff is what makes us happy. It is certainly not what I learned from my father. So what is the challenge? We know that we're in trouble. I'm not going to recite the litany of problems. We know the oceans are in terrible shape. And don't let this incredible sockeye run fool you into thinking DFO is doing a great job and everything's fine. Believe me, they're as shocked as we are. And that great run gives me hope that nature can be far more forgiving than we deserve. No one's got the right to say it's too late because we don't know enough about nature to say that it is too late. And I'm sure nature has got a lot of surprises in for us. We know that the forests, over 80% of the forests are gone, and if we continue to log and burn as we are, there won't be a single large old-growth forest left on the planet in 20 years. We know that we all carry dozens and dozens of toxic chemicals in our bodies because we've poisoned the air, water, and soil, and we know that the climate is changing as a result of our use of fossil fuels. You know this. We have to slow down. We have to reimagine the future. We have to get to know each other. because we're all in it together, and I believe communities are going to be the unit of survival. We have to think about children and grandchildren and the world we're leaving for them. So this is the challenge, is to do what our ancestors did all the time, to imagine the future, dream the future that we really want. Imagine a world where we live, work, and play in the same neighborhood. We don't need cars because the fun and action are going on right in our neighborhood. Where our children go out to play free of worry about speeding cars or perverts. I always think of my parents, you know, they used to say, David, go outside and play. And I used to complain, but Mom, it's raining. And she said, I don't care, go outside and play. But think of our kids today. Don't go outside. You know, there are speeding cars or there's some guy lurking behind a bush. We don't want our children to go out. We need cities where that's where all the fun and action are. Imagine buildings and roads that capture every bit of sunlight falling on them, where our roofs capture rain and grow food for us to eat. Imagine our cities filled with fruit and nut trees where we celebrate the seasons through the food that's right there available to us on our streets. Imagine a world where we extract heat from the earth in the winter and put that heat back down into the earth in the summer, where asthma rates plummet because the air is clean, where cancer rates are plummeting because we've cleaned up the air, water, and soil, where we drink water from any river or lake, as I did when I was a child, where we catch a fish and eat it without having to consult a book telling us what chemicals are in it, where we have zero waste, where all electricity comes from renewable sources, where dirigibles transport huge payloads over wilderness areas, where our excretion becomes food for other creatures that we ultimately end up eating ourselves, where the economy is in stasis or equilibrium with nature. And I could go on and on. And these things that I say we can imagine, they're not imaginary in the sense that carbon capture and sequestration is imaginary. That's imaginary. But we know that these things are going on in bits and pieces in places around the world. These are not simply fantasies that are not achievable. Let us dream of what is possible. Let us come together behind that goal, and then let us show what our species is truly capable of. This, then, is my legacy to you. Some food, I hope, for serious thought. Go to our website, davidsuzuki.org, to learn about us and how to take action in your workplace, in your schools, and in your personal lives. Please join us, and let's get going on the right path. Thank you very much.
From Vancouver, Canada, that was David Suzuki, host of the television show The Nature of Things, scientist, author of 40 books, and multiple award winner. Dr. Suzuki went on to say his real legacy may be his children, all environmentalists, and the David Suzuki Foundation, which has been very active in many environmental problems, especially climate change. Find out how you can help at davidsuzuki.org. I recorded this speech on September 17, 2010. This has been Radio EcoShock, hosted by Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.